So happy to be here this night, morning, or afternoon, depending on where you are. And we really are heard around the world. I get emails from virtually every corner of the world. It's wonderful to be here. Dr. Peter Ward is my guest. We're discussing, I guess the oil problem in the Gulf. I'll come up with something. And global warming, generally. And whether it's real or whether we're just, well, as some have said, a bunch of communists pumping out stuff that people don't like. People just don't like change, and they don't like negative change that will affect their lives negatively. If it's done correctly, you know, there really won't be the kind of change that I think a lot of people fear. And I think a lot of people fear it's back to the Stone Age or something, but it doesn't have to be that way. There are a lot of fixes, as Dr. Ward has suggested, simple things that people can do that would begin to change the world. You could paint all of the rooftops a light color, white, reflective of sunlight. And there would be just so many things that we could do and we're not doing. And what I wonder is why we're not doing them and why people are so angry is the only word I can come up with. There are others, but not suitable for Coast. Really angry when they hear about this. I've wondered about this for a long time. A question that I think I'll pose when we come back is, if ultimately there is not so many safe places on Earth, is there eventually, because obviously we're going in the other direction right now, is there going to be a new race for space to get to new, cooler territory? We'll be right back. Well, this is interesting. Zandra in Knoxville, Tennessee, fast blast me that, Art, everybody is being assured there's absolutely no shortage of oil. There's an infinite supply, it is said, on the planet. And I guess my view would be, well, if that is true, then what in the hell are we doing drilling for oil in 5 and 10,000 feet of water? Obviously, it's not all that safe to do that, and obviously there can be disasters when we do that. So if there was an infinite supply, then well, heck, why are we doing that? Professor?
No, I totally agree. This is the last really hard reach. And the other thing is, look, people are jockeying to get to the Arctic Sea as summer ice goes away or the winter ice goes away, and more of that is exposed. Russia and Canada and the U.S. are all fighting. Why would they be fighting to get oil that is in such a very difficult place to get to? I mean, at least in the Gulf, you don't freeze up. You're not talking about absolute, complete 6 months of darkness drilling down deep into the ocean at sub-freezing temperatures all around you. They wouldn't go there if there's lots of oil everywhere.
One wouldn't think so. There are disputed areas, for example, close to where I am, we have the Spratly Islands, claimed by the Philippines, claimed by China and others, and there's eventually going to be some sort of conflict about it all. Why? Because there is thought to be oil in the Spratlys, and that's just one little area that I know of and I can talk about, but we're going to be fighting over the last oil. Again, we're drilling in dangerous areas to find oil. Well, if there's an infinite supply of oil, why are we doing that?
I agree. There's just peak oil is a real concept. And Hubbard years ago suggested that there's going to be this nice bell-shaped curve. You hit the top and then it rolls down. Well, that's why we see China right now building power plants that are coal only. Mm-hmm. Why would they do that if there's so much oil? It's so much easier to make electricity from oil than it is from coal.
Sure. All of this should be obvious. Anyway, eventually, one does ask this question, and that is, will there be a new race for space, not this decade or next, but eventually, to find some place where we can comfortably live? Could that occur?
Could occur. Personally, I think there's a much greater chance the big fight's going to be over Greenland and it's going to be over Antarctica. Mm-hmm. I look at the deep past, mammal species if you look at the fossil record of them, normally last about 7 million years. We are only up to 200,000. That's an average mammalian species. So if we're average, we've got another 6 million years. At the rate at which we are melting ice within, a few thousand years, both Antarctica and way before that, Greenland will be without any ice at all. The bad news about both Greenland and Antarctica is that ice, when it sits on a rock surface, pushes it down. And once it melts away quickly, it bounces back. But we have pushed and squished the middle of Antarctica and the middle of Greenland so deeply that once the ice goes away, unless we build dams around the outside, both will get filled up with inland seas. We can't afford to let that happen. We're going to have to use these are huge new areas that will be productive. We could have a lot of humans living there. Antarctica is an enormous place. Yes, it'd be 6 months dark, 6 months light, but it will still be warm enough that you can grow crops there. So we're going to have to do some geoengineering to make sure those things don't get filled with salt water and are lost to agriculture. So that's, I think, the next 10,000 years is going to be the colonization. I do think, I don't want to sound cynical, but I suspect sea level is going to rise a minimum of 10 feet, and my guess is about 40 feet before we come to our senses and stop things over the next few thousand years. After 40 feet.
What senses are there left once 40 feet of sea rise?
Yeah, that's my guess.
What's left?
Well, there's a lot left. It turns out if you look at the 40-foot contours, there's plenty of land, but you've certainly lost all the coastal plains. And so people have moved up. Unfortunately, when you move up, up usually means the soil is way worse and is rockier and this and that. So we will have sort of really done away with the greatest agricultural gifts that this planet gave us, which is the lowland soil areas. But we'll muddle through. We'll get through with that. But we can't afford to lose Antarctica, and we can't afford to lose Greenland. And so big dams around the outside can be built. And once again, I've done that in this book, Flooded Earth. I've kind of mapped out our next 5,000 years in the book and showing how you can, and what we can do and what we'll have to fix and how we'll have to get around, because my guess is this flooding is inevitable. I just don't think we have
it. Well, sure. But I mean, before you sort of gloss over it, 40 feet, if you were to make a map and, with 40 feet of sea rise and then compare it to a map of today or 20 years ago,
you'd fail
that map would
right?
look, it would look a lot different, and there would be 1 billion, 2 billion people gone, dead.
Displaced. Well, we'll just say displaced. But yeah, the Gulf Coast is gone. Much of the eastern seaboard all the way up to the Appalachians is gone. The big Puget Lowlands is gone. The Sacramento Valley is now a great big inland sea. A lot of Australia. I mean, just on and on and on and on and on. It's a water world. It's a wholly different world. Yes.
Speaking of water world, about 10 years ago, I did a show with a fellow who had plans for a floating country. He was going to manufacture a floating, city at least. And I think in his mind he had country in mind, but the whole thing would float. Is that a future possibility?
Absolutely. In fact, the Dutch are planning on that right now. The Dutch are really smart. They recognize that, like I think, there's an inevitability to a pretty significant sea level rise. And what are we going to do about it? So as their country goes underwater, they are already now thinking of very large living areas which are floating. These are just gigantic floating regions. And the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, of all things, asked four different architects to come up with a New York of the 21st century. And they recognize, as I do, that right now New York is trying to, the intersection of land and sea in New York is hard. Concrete, seawalls, the Battery Street tunnels and the Battery Street cement areas, you've got to soften this intersection. You've got to have streets that can let salt water at periods flow through them. Look, right now we're building cities that have no ability to deal with infiltration of salt. All engineering, all city infrastructure is built on the idea that, yes, it's going to rain a lot, but it's fresh water. Our bridges, everything else, we just do not recognize right now what salt water can do to things. So we have to retrofit, and New York is already thinking that they're planning on a 5-foot sea level rise. What happens? And what happens is that in a hurricane, if sea level is 5 feet higher than it is now, there's no way you can get people to be evacuated out of the city. I mean, you just can't do it. A Katrina storm hitting New York where the sea level is 2 feet higher than now. Everything breaks down transportation-wise. You just can't get out. So you're going to have mass mortality. That's what's going to kill people, Art. It's going to be the storms, the superstorms hitting a globally warmed world where sea level has gotten up just enough that all these freeways and railway tracks and all the ways we have to get people out of cities, they don't work. And you're stuck there in a killing zone.
Look, before it ever gets to the point that you're talking about with the earth changes, you know, the magnitude where populations are shifting from one part of a continent to another or from continent to continent, there are going to be wars, Dr. Ward. I mean, that's big wars, bad wars, nuclear wars that are going to occur over water, over land, over immigration, over all kinds of things like that, with the, you know, the displacements that are going to occur. And so, again, let's talk a little bit about what would occur with a war. I don't know if you've studied that, but surely there would be some sort of nuclear winter, wouldn't there?
Yeah, there would, and I have studied that. My first part of my career was trying to figure out what killed the dinosaurs, so I was working right near Berkeley when the Alvarezes were there. I knew them well, and I was actually trying to prove that it was caused by impact, and I think I did a good job, at least in the group of fossils I worked at. So I knew about the Sagan nuclear winter ideas, and I was talking guys like Owen Toon and the people from the Colorado atmospheric groups, and from Rhode Island there's a big group, and there's modelers in Arizona. And so at these meetings, these guys would show what happens when a 2-kilometer, 5-kilometer asteroid hits the Earth. A lot of dust goes up into space. Well, a nuke does the same thing. And what killed the dinosaurs were months and months of darkness caused by the impactor coming in. Well, that's what nuclear winter is. Same thing, except nuclear winter has all the bad radiation with it too. And you've got to deal with that as well. And so this is certainly square one here on what we would have to deal with. Even small nukes throw up a whole lot of stuff. Art, I'm old enough, I lived in Seattle, Washington, when the Russians were exploding the largest nuclear bombs ever exploded on planet Earth. And we were not allowed to drink the milk after a while. I was like 8, 9, 10, 12 years old. And the earliest 1960s in 59 and 60, and these big bombs, these big atmospheric bombs, were messing up. It was cesium and strontium 90 that were just in the atmosphere, getting into the cows, concentrated in milk. And school lunch, we couldn't drink the milk. This is really nasty stuff when big things blow stuff up into the atmosphere. Bombs, even small bombs, do it. So it is a hideous possibility, and I think that, again, the single greatest threat to me of anything is still sea level rise.
Yes, but you say a hideous possibility. I think it's a hideous probability. If what you're saying about the sea level rise occurs, I don't see how you avoid wars. I just don't. It's probable, not possible. It's probable. And I just want to correct something. Suzanne in Albuquerque, New Mexico says, Art, for goodness sakes, I can't believe you're saying that the Vatican needs to rethink its stand on abortion. Suzanne, I didn't say that. I said it needs to rethink its stand on birth control. Now, they may be one and the same to you, but what is not yet created is not aborted. I'm certainly not at all in favor of abortion, but birth control is an entirely different story, and we do need to bring population control to the Catholic world. And I'm not anti-Catholic. In fact, I go to Catholic Church, but I can clearly see that population is a gigantic factor. It certainly is here in the Philippines and much of the rest of the Catholic world. So there's got to be a way to control population, or I don't know, the rest of it may be simply academic. It's just a matter of time, which seems as though it is anyway. Peter, we're going to go to the lines, the phones at the bottom of the hour, but anything that we didn't cover or should cover,
Well,
let's get it in
there. Art, I was going to ask you a question that still relates to this, but nevertheless, it's kind of fun and kind of interesting. Have you been following the massive jellyfish blooming events that have been happening for the last year?
Yes.
I have. Peculiar.
It is strange. And what was the story just a day or two ago about the jellyfish that was actually dead?
Yes, it was.
What happened? What's that all about?
Oh, it cracked me up. There's at this time of year, we had the big red ones. It was the East Coast, I believe. It was somewhere in New England. But a big jellyfish had gone up against a screen barrier to keep big jellyfish out so people could swim. And then apparently the tide went down, and jellyfish and the sun are not, and that's not a very compatible couple. Anyway, the thing disintegrated. What should have happened is that one of the lifeguards should have seen, uh-oh, a big jellyfish, and come over with some really strong gloves on and just put it in the plastic bag and carried it away. Instead, they let it sit there, waves hit it, it breaks up, and the stinging cells, as you well know, and any of these jellyfish are things called nematocysts on the tentacles. Each one is a self-contained little stinger, like a bee stinger, with poison in it. Well, those broke into a zillion tiny pieces of stinging flesh that just washed into the area where the people were. So it was kind of stupidity, right? Darwin Award type stuff. At least it wasn't a killer jellyfish. But what I find fascinating is that we're seeing blooms, if you will. Bloom meaning the gigantic population increases of jellyfish in lots of different places. Against up in England, they were so common and so big that they're apparently just absolutely filling up the nets so that the fishermen can't get their fish. But what I see is that these guys are really low on the evolutionary tree of animals. These are right down there. They come from really warm water systems, very primitive warm water systems. These are canaries. I mean, these are canaries in the mine shaft of world's oceans, telling us that there's some really deep, deeply dysfunctional stuff going on there. I just find it fascinating that these guys are riding in like the fifth apocalypse in their little jelly bodies, but it's telling us something profoundly, I think.
So it is telling us something profound.
Oh, yeah. This isn't just like, I mean, in our long lives, how many times have you heard stories about jellyfish, monstrous population blooms of jellyfish in many parts of the world? You know, I teach marine biology. This hasn't happened in my lifetime. All of a sudden.
Not mine. No, I saw the story and I went,
Yeah.
Why? And you're saying it's because of warm waters.
Oh, absolutely. These guys just do better in warm oceans. They came from warm oceans. You know, there used to be, the ancient world was a lot warmer than now. We had way more CO2 in the past. And so we're going back, you know, we're rapidly approaching sort of the greenhouse world that we know of, we call the Mesozoic. The Jurassic Park world was a greenhouse world with CO2 where it will soon be here. And all those worlds, even prior to that, were globally warmed, and we had an awful lot of these things called cnidarians or cementerates. They were the dominant life form, real simple, jellyfish, corals, and all their ilk, real soft-bodied. They never have really big, hard skeletons other than the hard, stony corals. And these guys, they're coming back. Hey, I like this world. I remember this.
All right. Somebody goes by the name of Boss, identifying himself as only from the great Northwest, says, Art, why are you afraid of opposing opinions on this subject? There are many out there who have suffered the wrath of the fascists left to try to bring you to the truth. Lord Mockton, and George Taylor, to name a couple, ice sheets break from excess snow and ice not warming. You have any comment on that, Peter? I mean, just too much cold and ice is what's destroying these ice sheets. That's what he's saying.
Sometimes you get too much snow because of warming. I mean, you're not getting the normal freeze. You're getting the snow instead. I mean, just let's look at this. And the other thing that made me laugh, opinion and science, those don't equate here.
All right. Hold it right there. We'll be right back. This is Coast to Coast AM. Indeed so. Here I am. My guest is Professor Peter Ward. We're talking about the oil problem. in the Gulf. We're talking about global warming and the general state of things. And listen, bring it on. Now, I've read some of what's come in from the keyboards, but it's time to leave the keyboards and come to the phones. So if you, and I've instructed the call screener, and yes, we do screen calls when we have a guest here, to allow those who are in opposition to Dr. Ward and myself, for that matter, to come on through, come on down, and voice your opposition. We would we'd love to hear from you. You don't have a good debate unless you have both sides of an issue. And so I am indeed inviting you to pick up the phone. And while I'm certainly going to implore you to try and be polite, but in opposition, you're welcome. Absolutely welcome. Looking forward to it. The great debate. And it is a great debate, isn't it? I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM, and we will be right back. Well, okay. You ready, comrade?
Yeah, I'm ready. Peter? I'm ready. Let me grab the right phone, though. I have this phone. All right, I'm back. Now I'm ready.
All right. I have no idea what lies ahead, but there's only one way to find out. And I guess this would be east of the Rockies. East of the Rockies, if it's you, you're on the air.
Yes, this is east of the Rockies, Jeff calling okay. from Ferguson, Missouri.
Okay, welcome.
Thank you. Just a quick comment and then to my question, if I can make it fast.
Sure.
When the left does all this stuff for global warming, taking care of the planet, stuff like that, they're called taking care of the planet. When people like me who are conservatives does it, get solar stuff, gardens, they're called survivalists, right-wing survivalists. I kind of noticed that.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation, actually.
But anyway, if the planet decides to go all screwy, no matter what we do, changing light bulbs or anything like that, can we really make a difference if the planet itself decides to go all screwy, no matter what we do?
All right. Well, I guess that's a reasonable question. Professor, what say you? If the planet... despite whatever else happens, goes completely screwy. No, there's not going to be a lot we can do, is there? Up against nature and what will be, we're not much. We can apply the best science we have, but maybe that will not be enough.
Well, I take a little bit of exception to the word the planet decides. You know, planet's not going to decide anything. We're the only creatures on this planet that really can decide much of anything in a way powerful enough to affect the planet. There's no other animal on this planet that can really make a decision and therefore change stuff. And we made the decision we don't like to be cold in winter, and the effect is we've really changed it. So I don't think the planet has anything to say about it. I think it's almost entirely humanity which is making these decisions.
Well, a favorite saying of mine would be that Mother Nature doesn't get mad. She gets even.
I agree. There you go.
So, in other words, if something is wickedly out of balance, you know, there's something Mother Nature, I guess, tries to return the balance. It's that simple. To California, Mendocino, I believe, California, you're on the air with Dr. Peter Ward and Art Bell. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, Art and Peter. My question is on how we can possibly have decent oversight of what's going on, for instance, in the Gulf. And here in California, our Chief Justice of the Supreme Court is about to retire. We have a Filipino woman who is being put up before the voters. And it seems to me that somebody like that who would understand the impact of how water would affect our coastline and up into Stockton and the levees and all the Delta Zone would be the kind of person that we need in government to have that kind of oversight. Love government or not, that's the way it is. And by the way, Art, this woman supported herself after law school as a blackjack dealer in Reno, Nevada. So I thought you might be interested in that little aside. But the aspect of, like, Thad Allen, is he the admiral of the Coast Guard or is he a civilian? It appears sometimes that he's retired and then other times they show him with the four stars. Is he now a spokesperson for BP what is his role at this point? It's very confusing to the public. And, you know, to know what's going on, I think it'd be helpful for the public, and to know the representation that we have in there, in spite of all its flaws, at least we're supposed to have transparency as opposed to the obscurity of corporations. It seems there's a corporate takeover here. So I'd like your take on how we should look at these situations possibly in the future. What would be a decent structure so we have significant and effective oversight on these horrible type situations, which are bound to occur again? Thank you.
Okay. And they are bound to occur. Professor?
Yeah, well, a great caller, and boy, you speak in beautiful sentences. I mean, honest. I lived 8 years in Davis, California. I worked at UC Davis, and one of my best friends, Jeff Mount, there is worrying greatly about things you're talking about, water in the Great Valley, the Central Valley. You guys in Central California, you've got that entire Delta region that is going to be so affected by sea level change. We have to keep the Sacramento Valley and the San Joaquin Valley producing food, or we're going to run into one of these enormous, enormous mortality events. And when you're saying that we need great representation, I mean, you've hit the nail on the head. What we need more than anything else on this planet right now is leadership that is coming from A, wisdom, but B, a great sense of intellect. I mean, we need people who can think and really work out where the problems are, where the priorities are, and how to fix them. And right off the bat, this whole Gulf business, this Fat Allen, we're all just praying that the man seems as competent as he appears to be. He gives a great TV appearance. So far, it looks as if his leadership is leading this out of, if it is his leadership, but I get a quiet sense of confidence. But where I'm now worried is the announcement that the other oil companies are going to put together a rapid response team. Well, that's great on the surface. Who's going to lead it? Who decides that, okay, now is the time to spring into action? Which of the companies puts out was the closest or pays the most or whatever? I mean, where do we find that leader? And this is just all over in every one of these situations. We have to come up with people with the correct leadership skills right now. It's just so clear. It hasn't happened in the BP response. It seems to be happening now, but it took a while, didn't it?
Peter, I don't understand how we get people elected to office who are insulated from the pressures of the money that comes from oil. I just don't understand how we do it with the current structure. In fact, it's not just America, it's virtually every country. You know, money rules and the rest walks. And so how do we get people into office that are insulated from that sufficiently to bring policies that are going to prevent a catastrophe in the fairly near future?
Term limits. I think term limits are a great thing, and certainly we see people who go in and do great work, and just over time, it seems that they erode away. The scariest model for what long-term corrosion, I think, happens to politicians is exactly what we're seeing taking place in Mexico now. The drug money is so intense, it's so huge, that we see all of those institutions going down. Well, look, the oil money is not, they're not killing people like the drug money is, but they're certainly perverting situations and especially organizations. There is just so much money. When gasoline went up to $4 a gallon around here and those profits were in the billions per month, that has to affect a great number of people. I don't know how leadership arises, but I do know that oil and drugs, they're both huge, big money enterprises, and the corrosive power of each is enormous.
Let's go to Bill in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Bill. You're on with Professor Ward.
Hi, Mr. Ward and Art. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. My question is the Horizon well out in the Gulf, it's pulling oil from 10,000 feet under the sea. Like when I was in school, I was taught that 5,000. The oil came from plant life and animal life. How could it possibly be that deep?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And when I was growing up, they had one of these great ads for a place called Sinclair Oil. And the way it was, there was this dinosaur walking around, and then it fell down to the ground, and it got sucked up on this oil well.
I remember that. I remember that.
Yeah. Well, that was wow. I said, Dad, look, dinosaurs turned to oil. They're in our core.
That's right.
You're absolutely right. The oil did come from plant life, and it did come from some animal life, mostly plant life. But that's plant life that got squished. I mean, these are plants. They're so far from being plants now. They've been in rock for a long time, and they've been so heated and so compressed that there's even their cell walls have changed. They've gone through this metamorphism from really complex structures like cells that we have today to very simple long-chain carbons. But these long-chain carbons are what we call reduced, and reduced carbon contains energy. You oxidize it, and boom, out comes power. So you're right, it is plants, but it's plants that are, in the case of the oil down there, we're talking plants that are 50 to 60 to 70 million years ago, they were plants, and they've been sitting down in that sediment for all that time since.
Well, you know, it's funny. I do remember that. I remember the Sinclair ad. And I also remember ads when I was younger from doctors who would come on television and tell us that cigarettes are healthy and good for us. You remember that?
Oh, I do. And it's funny, too, because we have this long-running three-year series. I think it's since you left, called Mad Men. And in it, they've got these ad guys trying to figure out how to teach people that smoking can't hurt you, even while they're smoking like crazy. Yeah, it's an interesting point of view.
Okay, let's go to the first-time caller line and say good morning. You're on the air. Where are you?
Hey, Art, how you doing there? And Dr. Peter Ward, how you doing there?
I'm good, doing well, and thanks for asking. It's 2 a.m. where I am.
Oh,
maybe it's 1 a.m.
Yeah, it's almost 3 here. I'm in Alexandria, Louisiana, and I really do appreciate, Gina, your call screener. Thank you for taking my call and everything. My name is Cornelius. I listen to you on 970 KSYL. And, Art, I was the one that predicted if the Saints win, it'd be the end of the world.
Your fault, man. It's your fault.
Anyway, I was telling Gina, I just wanted to know if it gets any worse, will it be the end for us if it does get any worse? So that was my question. I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, when you say, before you go, when you say the end for us, do you mean everybody, or do you mean, for example, you there in Louisiana?
I tell you, Art, that's a good question, too. I know with this moratorium, it's going to be the end for us as far as, you know.
Economically.
Yeah.
Okay. There is that. You know, in Louisiana, they're very dependent, of course, on the drilling that's going. And but you know what? I understand we need oil. And I understand that no matter what we do from today forward, and I was saying this in the 70s, that we've got to have oil until we have something else. What's really ticking me off is that we don't have something else yet, that we're not moving in that direction, that even the disaster in the Gulf has not started us moving heavily in the direction we should be moving. And if this doesn't do it, what will? So, Professor, I don't know. His question was, is it the end?
It's not the end. I think it's actually a way. I think this could be the beginning. I think you could look at this as there's going to be, first of all, the United States of America has never in its history, since Andrew Jackson, concentrated as much on the Gulf region. I have been glued to my television screen, and I've been telling my kid, look, we're going down there. I've got to see this place. It looks so beautiful. And yet you see the heart-wrenching aspects of it, but the richness of the place. I think the Gulf, I think you're going to see an enormous rebirth here. I think anybody who goes through a near-death experience comes back, if they have any wisdom at all, and realizes, wow, that was close. I'm going to do something now. I've got some time left. And this is my sense of what's going to happen in the Gulf, that we are going to see a rich cultural region become even richer. The survivorship that comes out of this, I think, is going to bind you Gulf people. I just see it's going to be really a wonderful, optimistic new place. Maybe that's just wishful thinking, but I really do. In a way, I envy you. You're going through a united experience.
Well, I do think that But the people in the Gulf have a sort of a rebirth of thought about things. But I don't think that that translates to a national rebirth at all. In fact, once the cap went on the well, you'll notice that the media coverage changed drastically. Now, it hasn't gone away, but we forget about things very quickly, out of sight, out of mind. I hope it's not true, but I fear it is. Wildcard Line, top of the morning. You're on the air with Dr. Peter Ward and Art Bell.
Oh, hello, Art Bell. It's an honor to talk to you because back in the 90s, my mom would take middle of the night drives and listen to you. My brother would quote, say, Mom, please don't put the scary guy on until I fall asleep. Yeah.
The scary guy, okay.
Yeah. Well, my question is, what is the most economical and efficient way to change our habits?
The most economical way to change our habits.
We
don't seem to change much in the U.S. or in the world until we're forced to change, until there's an emergency or enough people die or that forces change. Other than that, we don't change. You know, we have a comfort level, and we don't want that to change.
Well, I know the easiest way. Just put $5 a gallon tax on gasoline. You're going to see a big change. We'll never do it. I mean, anybody who suggested it would be lined up in the dawn and shot. Nevertheless, look what the Europeans do. I mean, they have most of their fiscal money comes from gasoline tax. They spend at least 2 to 3 times more per gallon, equivalent gallon, than we do. You put $5 a gallon on it, and all those trips to the store all by yourself you didn't need to do anyway, they're gone, right? You're going to start doing rapid transit. We're going to stop sucking so much oil out of the ground. That's going to be a big change.
You know what? I think you're right. I mean, you actually hit on something. If you were to make add $5 a gallon to gas.
Absolutely.
That would change a great deal. In fact, in the world of smoking, that did change the world. It really got a lot of people to kick the habit simply because they couldn't afford it anymore. So you're absolutely right, Professor. That's a good call. Add $5, but of course it's political death.
Yep, it is. It is. And so the whole question becomes, how much national courage and national will do we really have?
Not that much. Not that much. You know, cigarettes, well, it was a pretty easy target, you know. Revenue, we all think it's bad, so slam tax on it. And it did work.
Yep.
But that's an easy target compared to oil.
Yep.
Gas. International Line, you're on the air with Dr. Peter Ward and Art Bell. Hi.
Hi, Art Bell. First time, thank you. And Dr. Peter, my question is that... is it U.S. currency is attached to the oil? That's why America doesn't want to do anything about it. We saw that you have a lot of oil in the United States, but I don't know what's going on in the world. That the U.S. has to go all over the world to war or anything like that. So I just wonder, is that the case, the money tied up to the oil?
Of course it's the case. Oil, money, oil. Right, Professor?
Boy, you're right, partner.
So, you know, that says it. Money, oil, politicians, decisions affected by oil and money. How do we change that? Beats me.